This is from the Book of Charlie, and this is about Charlie's childhood and the fact that cars were made. This past met the future in Charlie's Odyssey. You see, not long after Charlie's 8th birthday, the Ford Motor Company introduced one of the most transformative innovations in economic history, the Industrial Assembly Line. Ford's new factory in Highland Park, Michigan, cut the time needed to build an automobile body by 75%. Additional lines were rapidly added to work similar wonders in the production of engines, transmissions, and wheel assemblies. A Model T Ford that required 12 hours to build in 1912 rolled off the line in a mere 93 minutes by 1916. This enormous gain in efficiency allowed Ford to nearly double the wages of its workers while cutting the price of each car by one-third. The Model T knocked America for a loop. Cheap, sturdy, and easy to repair, these simple cars, available in every color, it was said, provided the color was black, unleashed something primal in the human genome. For thousands of years, humans had moved at walking speeds over walking distances. Now this huffing, sputtering machine remade geography, economies, societies, highways, service stations, truck plazas, motels, fast food restaurants, shopping malls, suburbs, all were the product of this one invention, the affordable, dependable automobile. It was pure freedom to go as one wished and stop as one would. So this guy Charlie decides after he graduates from high school, he's going to go west from Kansas City to Los Angeles. The boys had a similar trip in mind. They knew, or thought they knew, how rough the journey could be. Kansas City's roads were notoriously bad. The same year Charlie and his friends finished high school, a young artist a few years older named Walt Disney was trying to get a business started not far from Charlie's house. Working in a new art form known as animation, Disney sold a series of short films to the Newman Theater downtown, cartoon commentaries on local issues that Disney called Laugh-O-Grams. The vignettes played before main feature films on nights when the Newman's vaudeville stage was silent. One Disney animation poked fun at the dangers of driving in Kansas City. The young artist sketched two passengers in a flivver, a Model T, flying several feet above their car as one wheel caromed off an outcropping while another sank into a pothole. Audiences were charmed by the novel shorts, which almost seemed alive, but Disney's Kansas City business failed to take wing, and so, like Charlie, young Disney struck out for California, though Disney chose to go by train. Next, I skipped ahead where they start their trip out west, the two boys. They set out in late spring of 1922. Two boys on the front bench of the car, the third sprawled across the bench in the back. Moving not much faster than a jog, they jostled slowly out of town in the wake of the wagon trains, across lightly marked fields, over the grass-blown flint hills, and onto the high flat plains. They picked their way from marker to marker with only the old trail's guidebook to help them. There were really no roads, no maps, Charlie recalled. We had a sort of directory which would say, go 10 miles this way and you'll find a big hemlock tree and turn right. That sort of direction. At nearly every crossroads, they saw hand-painted signs advertising farm work at $6 per day. Wealthy Bob Long had plenty of cash, as Charlie remembered it, and kept driving until they reached a town large enough to boast a handsome hotel, where he rented a room and passed the time with Charlie and Ed, while Charlie and Ed got busy on a farm nearby. From sunup to sundown, we worked in that hot sun stacking wheat, Charlie recalled. The city boys had a lot to learn. On their first day, the youngest graduates of Westport High were introduced to a primitive device called a header, an open drum of whirling blades pulled by four horses harnessed abreast. The machine cut wheat and sent it up a rattling conveyor belt to fall into a horse-drawn wagon moving slowly alongside. Leading the horses through the scratchy fields was hard work. Wheat dust filled the boys' noses and powdered their sweat-wet bodies. When the big wagon could hold no more, the boys drove it to a central gathering place where they bundled and stacked the crop in sheaves for the thresher. We slept on the ground, Charlie told me. We were so exhausted. Sometimes we got a bath in a horse tank. Though I heard Charlie tell this story a number of times, I never dulled to his marvelous self-confidence. Not only had he set out at age 16 to cross the country on unpaved roads, not only had he done it without letting anyone know where he was going or when he would return, he did it with empty pockets, sure that he could make his way somehow. Though he knew next to nothing about farming, he had faith in his own ability to learn quickly and to work hard. It was funny, Charlie mused, because we were just high school kids. We didn't understand how to harness horses and all. When we first went out there, the farmers threw us a set of harnesses at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, "Harness the horses." We had a terrible time. We got that harness on backwards. He chuckled at the memory. We finally manipulated it and became expert in a few days, like high school kids will. I love that line, like high school kids will. Charlie and his intrepid friend Ed not only had the courage they needed, they also understood the strengths they brought to the table. Older workers could beat them on skill and experience, but they made up for it with their eagerness to grow and adapt. Resourcefulness is a close cousin of resilience. Rather than be defeated in advance by their lack of experience and credentials, the boys were resourceful about leveraging the material at hand, starting with the learning attitude of youth. After a week and a half in the wheat fields, Charlie and Ed were pretty solid farmhands, with hardened muscles and $50 apiece. They could feel the money burning in their pockets. "We said, 'We're wealthy,'" Charlie recalled. "Let's go to California." The adventurers stopped for food and fuel at tiny general stores once they got going again. "There were no gas stations," Charlie told me. "You got your gas at a grocery store. There were no rest stops either. As I remember, there were no places to sleep. We just slept on the ground. Of course, if it was raining, we got underneath the car." When they drove past sundown, their headlamps, powered by the little magneto, brightened and dimmed according to their speed. If you were going to drive at night, you had to drive at least 25 miles an hour to get enough power, Charlie explained. The faster you drove, the better your lights were, but the roads were so bad it would bounce you out of the car almost. Now their route passed through the coal fields of southern Colorado, notorious for the violence and oppression of the labor uprisings there. 8 years earlier, Colorado's governor had dispatched the National Guard to break up a tent city of striking miners known as the Ludlow Encampment. Employees of the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, the strikers, mostly immigrants and African Americans, were defying an owner whose very name was synonymous with wealth and power, J.D. Rockefeller Jr. The guardsmen arrived on horseback in an armored car with a mounted machine gun. They took position on a ridge over the camp and opened fire. At least 7 miners were killed. More than a dozen women and children took cover in a bunker where they suffocated when the guardsmen torched the tents above them. The Ludlow Massacre, as the tragedy came to be known, sparked retaliatory killings of mine guards, foremen, and managers throughout the region, and a war that raged until President Woodrow Wilson sent regular U.S. Army troops to restore order. Charlie recalled only the gradual change of scenery as they motioned through La Junta, an early trading station on the Santa Fe Trail. After hundreds of miles of gray-brown prairie, they entered the green shrubland of the High Chaparral. In the western distance, the jagged Sangre de Cristo Mountains filled the horizon like a purple wave foamed with snow. If the boys had been climbers, they would have found on that horizon some of the most forbidding peaks of the entire Rocky Mountain chain. Instead, they turned their chugging buggy south, keeping the mountains on their right, puttering toward an easier crossing. A week into the trip, the boys blew out a tire. With no jack in the car, Ed Snow, the strongest of the three, strained to lift one corner of the vehicle high enough to let the other boys slip on the spare. Wary of another blowout, they crept along to the next town where they bought 4 replacements at the general store. Hopefully you've enjoyed this portion of the Book of Charlie.